Well, can I welcome everyone here tonight? It's a great pleasure to welcome in particular Professor Norman Cohen. A lot of years ago, I was a student in Hull, and my main teacher was an anthropologist called Peter Worsley, who had written a book himself called The Trumpet Shall Sound about cargo cults. Hence, he was heavily into millenarian movements, and among the first things I was ever taught was a lot of literature about millenarianism, in which the pursuit of the millennium was the star book, is indeed a star book of 20th century history and social science, one of the great books, I think. So it's very good to have Professor Cohen here, and this is a fairly exceptional occasion to get him out to the city to give the lecture. Professor Cohen started his career in languages, first of all. He was first apparently professor of French. In the early 1960s, he changed his focus to history and also to something else for which he became famous, the study of genocide. He has held many academic positions through the world, including at King's College London, Rhodes University, Stanford, California, Wesleyan University, Connecticut, Netherlands Institute for Advanced Study, Concordia University, Montreal, the list goes on. He is a professor emeritus at the University of Sussex. As everyone in the audience will know, he's the author of a number of very famous books. The one I mentioned, The Pursuit of the Millennium, I think probably is still the most famous, and certainly to me it's the most famous book, deservedly so. It's come back into fashion because it's so plainly relevant to questions we ask about the millennium now and what millenarianism actually is. One of his other books, Warrant for Genocide, is currently in its third edition. By the way, The Pursuit of the Millennium is in its fourth edition. So let me say again what an honor it is to welcome him here to the LSE. His lecture tonight is All the M's, Millenarianism, Mainly Medieval. Professor Cohen.
But it's a bit depressing to think that I have to live up to that. I do what I can. And let me start with a word of reassurance. Because although... Can you hear me now all right? Anybody not hear me? You can't hear me. Now, suppose I stand in the middle and ignore this thing. Can everybody hear me?
Stand in the middle of them, speak normally.
All right, that's what I'll do. And if anybody really finds that, you know, it's, I wouldn't say that it's too boring, I should ignore that, but if you find that you really can't hear me, give a sign, and I'll do my best. Yes, millenarianism, mainly medieval. And let me start with a word of reassurance, because although millenarianism figures in the title, I'm not going to say anything about the year 2000, the millennium of which we have been and alas still are hearing so much. The millennium that I'm concerned with is quite a different matter. Now originally, millennium, it tends to be forgotten these days, but originally it was a theological term. It referred to the 1,000 years during which, according to the book of Revelation, Christ will reign on this earth before the last judgment. Even in the book of Revelation, this millennium has nothing to do with the year 1000 or 2000, or indeed with any particular date. And in recent years, the meaning of millenarian has been widened still further. It's become customary amongst anthropologists and sociologists, and to some extent also amongst historians, to use the word simply as a convenient label for a particular kind of salvationism. And that's how I'm using the word. Now, I must indicate, as best I can, the kind of salvationism I have in mind. the movements that I'm going to look at, they differ widely from one another, but they all have certain features in common. The salvation that they envisage is always imagined as three things. Firstly, it's imagined as collective, in the sense that it's to be enjoyed by the faithful as a group. It's not a matter of individual salvation, it's a matter of collective salvation. And second, it's terrestrial, in the sense that it's to be realized on this earth and not in some otherworldly paradise. And thirdly, it is total. Total in the sense that it's utterly to transform life on this earth. So that the new dispensation, the millenarian dispensation, if you like, will be no mere improvement on the present lamentable state of affairs, but it will be perfection itself. That applies to, I think those three things apply to all movements that are commonly nowadays called millenarian. It certainly applies to the ones that I'm going to consider. And of course, millenarianism in this sense, which is, of course, as I've said, a broad sense, but I think it's precise enough, it's playing a great part in the world today. But there's nothing new in that. And in this talk, I'm going to consider two very different kinds of millenarian movement that flourished in Western Europe between the late 12th and the early 16th century. And when I've done that, assuming that I still got any audience at all, I shall try to comment briefly on what seems to me to be the sociological significance of those movements. Now, the earlier of my two kinds of millenarianism is known to historians as Joachimism. And Joachimism was essentially a protest against the growing wealth and worldliness of the church. The way of life of the upper clergy had indeed been much changed by the great economic revival, which took place, had been gathering momentum through the 12th century. Now, after centuries when economic activity had been really very restricted, suddenly trade revived, and money began to circulate in much greater quantities, and that affected the church. Popes and bishops and abbots all felt the consequences. The papacy, to start with the papacy, developed a vast system of taxation, and this in turn enabled it to behave in many ways like a great secular monarchy. Popes not only maintained splendid courts, they also hired armies, and they fought battles, and sometimes won. Bishops built themselves palaces where they lived in the same splendid style as other great feudal lords. And even the monasteries, many monasteries, became luxurious establishments. Joachimism developed as a protest against this state of affairs. The man after whom this movement was named, Joachim, abbot of Fiore in Calabria, Italy, South Italy, was not consciously unorthodox. On the contrary, he never would have set down his ideas in writing at all, but for the fact that three popes in succession asked him to do so. On his deathbed, he explicitly submitted all his writings to the Holy See. And nevertheless, in the whole of the Middle Ages, there was scarcely another thinker who did so much to shake the structure of Orthodox medieval theology. There were very few whose influence proved, in the long run, so damaging to the Church of Rome. Towards the end of the 12th century, in the 1190s, in other words, Joachim received a number of mystical illuminations, which guided him to what he believed to be the hidden meaning of the scriptures. Moreover, he was convinced that this hidden meaning, as it was gradually revealed to him, provided the key to the future development of history. And on the basis of his interpretation of the Old and New Testaments put together, Joachim elaborated an interpretation of history as an ascent through three ages. each reflecting one of the persons of the Trinity. The three ages overlap with one another, they emerge from one another, and this he said, this embodied the mystery of the Son, of Jesus, the Son emerging and the Spirit emerging from the Father. No matter, the first age reflecting the Father was initiated by Adam, and that was the age of married people. Adam, after all, having set the example. The second age, reflecting the Son, Jesus, began long before Jesus with the prophet Isaiah, and this was the age of clerics. That, by the way, because Joachim's interest was really concentrated above all on the third age, reflecting the Spirit. This third age began to emerge already in the age of the Father with the appearance of the prophet Elisha. It unfolded further in the age of the Son with the appearance of St. Benedict, and it's to complete its unfolding in the near future. As the first age was the age of the married, the second was the age of clerics, so this third age was to be the age of spiritual monks. He regarded the Benedictines, the Benedictine order, as the nearest approach. They were the precursors of these monks-to-be. And the third age, this final, it will be the final age. It will lead to the end of the world and to the last judgment. The spiritual monks represent the absolute triumph of the spirit over the flesh. They are contemplatives, wrapped in mystical ecstasy, wholly indifferent to the things of this world. In their spirituality, he said, they are as far superior to their predecessors, the Benedictines, as Christ was to the prophets. And through their spirituality, they were going to transform the world. And with great eloquence, Joachim indicates the differences between the three ages. The first age was passed in slavish servitude, he says. The second in filial submission. But the third age will be the age of liberty. The first age was the age of fear. The second was the age of faith. But in the third age, love alone will reign. What impressed men of the 13th century was, above all, Joachim's account of how and when the world was to undergo its final transformation. And Joachim was ready for this. He computed the duration of the second age as 42 generations, each lasting 30 years from the birth of Christ. This meant that the third age must emerge from its period, as it were, of incubation and attain full development between 1200 and 1260. There would, he said, be a time of great tribulation. That is normal with millenarian fantasies. But at the same time, spiritual understanding would increase. And finally, the third age would come in its fullness. Now, in all this, there were explosive potentialities. And how explosive emerged when Joachim's doctrine became associated with the religious cult of absolute poverty. And so we come to St. Francis. But St. Francis and his first followers in the early years of the 13th century had practiced absolute poverty. They refused to own anything whatsoever. Later, when that humble confraternity turned into a great order, it made concessions, as normally happens. It made concessions to the demands of everyday reality, and it acquired very substantial property. But some Franciscans refused. They refused to accept the change. They clung to the ideal of absolute poverty. These were the Franciscan spirituals. At first, they simply represented one tendency within the Franciscan order. But by the 1270s, they formed a faction which was openly at loggerheads with the superiors of the order. Early in the 14th century, the spirituals went further and broke first with the Franciscan order and then with the Church of Rome itself. through their rigid adherence to the original ideals of St. Francis, the spirituals in the south of France and in Italy found themselves in the position of heretics. Now, amongst these spirituals, Joachimite ideas flourished mightily. However, they were no longer the ideas of Joachim himself, but of other writers who took over his prophecy of the coming age of the Spirit. They also simplified it, and they gave it a twist that would have horrified Joachim. Because Joachim, as I've said, never attacked the Church of Rome. He never suggested that it was to be superseded. In his prophecies, the Church is to continue throughout the Third Age, only purified and spiritualized. The pseudo-Joachimite prophecies, current amongst the spirituals, offer a very different prospect. In them, the Church of Rome is damned for its worldliness. It's to disappear and to be replaced by, guess it, by the spirituals themselves. They and they alone will lead mankind into the glories of the age of the Spirit. A spiritual will mount the papal throne as Papa Angelica, the angel pope. And all this will happen in the immediate future. The fact that Joachim's own Terminus et Quem, the year 1260, had long passed, made no difference. The date was simply postponed again and again. Inevitably, the spirituals were condemned by the Church and persecuted accordingly. Four were burned at Marseille in 1318. There were many more executions to follow. Equally inevitably, this persecution in turn increased the fury of the spirituals against the Church. They came to see the Church as the whore of Babylon, and the Pope as Antichrist. They looked forward to the day when all the clergy would be massacred. It was a furious confrontation between a mighty established institution and small groups of radical dissenters. And yet, it was not a case of class conflict. The spirituals weren't, as has sometimes been suggested, poor peasants or artisans protesting against the socio-economic system that was exploiting them. Nothing of the kind. Originally, they were Franciscan friars, and later, when this ceased to be the case, they were drawn from townsfolk of all kinds, and not simply, or even mainly, from the poor. When these people condemned the wealth and worldliness of papacy and church, they were protesting not against economic exploitation, but against the defection of spiritual authority. And here, I think, we're confronted with a social factor of the utmost importance, and one which must be borne constantly in mind if one's to understand the heretical sects of the later Middle Ages. In the medieval world, the Church stood as a divinely ordained authority which, with its prescriptions and demands, embraced the life of every Christian. And it was the one institution which, through its sacraments, could offer hope of salvation after death. But in the eyes of medieval people, the surest sign of grace was asceticism, and the existing Church had about it much that was only too manifestly unascetic. Was it possible, then, that the Church had lost its spiritual validity, had ceased to be a vehicle of divine grace? The very thought, the very possibility of doubt about so vital a matter was bound to engender intolerable anxieties. It was in response to these anxieties that sectarians of all kinds elaborated their various creeds. And in the case of the spirituals, the response took the form of a millenarian fantasy. In the view of the spirituals, the authority which had been forfeited by the existing Church was to pass to a new, poverty-loving Church of the third and last age, represented by themselves. And as in all millenarian fantasies, the imperfect existing order was to be replaced not by one less imperfect, but by perfection itself. The age of the Spirit was to be an age of supernatural bliss and harmony, while the spirituals themselves were, in their own eyes, almost supernatural beings, endowed with divine insight, such as had hitherto been enjoyed only by Christ himself. That's the first of my two kinds of medieval millenarianism, and I think you will, without much difficulty, see parallels amongst the millenarian movements of today. But it's time now to consider another form of millenarianism, which appeared towards the close of the Middle Ages and which was revolutionary in the modern sense of the word. In part, it was derived from a very ancient idea. Already in the ancient world, it was a commonplace that once upon a time, long, long ago, human beings had lived in a state of total equality and community, holding all things in common, knowing nothing of mine or thine. And this idea was taken over by the Catholic Church. The Church Fathers, like the pagan writers, held that this total equality was the original intention of God. From them, the idea passed to the theologians of the Middle Ages. But all this was a matter of theory. All this was a matter of theory only. It was certain heretical preachers who, towards the end of the 14th century, were the first to try to call this egalitarian state of nature out of the depths of the past and to represent it as an attainable ideal. And in doing so, they provided the basis for a new revolutionary form of millenarianism. From then on, the millennium could be pictured as a recreation of that lost golden age where social classes and private property were unknown. The close of the Middle Ages were accompanied by great social upheavals. These upheavals were not caused by any millenarian idea, far from it. But it is a fact that while they were taking place, there also appeared various extremist groups which really were convinced that at any moment an egalitarian, communistic millennium would be established by the direct intervention of God. I'll look at a couple of examples. We find such groups, for instance, in the great Hussite Revolution, which broke out in Bohemia in 1419. Now here the chief preacher was one Martinek Hauska. What this man preached to his followers was that as, I quote, avenging angels of God and warriors of Christ, they must exterminate all sinners, whom he identified with the nobles and the rich. When this task had been thoroughly performed, Christ would descend from heaven and establish his millennial kingdom with its center in Bohemia. And in that kingdom, all things would be held in common. In preparation for this event, the extremists amongst the Hussites actually set up a system of total community of goods in the territories which they dominated. Moreover, they planned to impose this system of total community of goods on the whole world, this little group of radical Hussites. All people, they said, must always hold everything in common, and nobody must possess anything of his own. Whoever owns private property commits a mortal sin. They were resolved to extirpate that sin. They declared themselves to be, I quote, an army sent through the world to carry the plagues of vengeance and judgment upon every people that shall resist them. And after that, the sons of God shall tread on the necks of kings, and all realms under heaven shall be given unto them. That was what they looked forward to. In the event, other revolutionaries of a more practical cast of mind soon deprived these extremists of all power. And during the years of warfare that followed, while the Bohemian Hussites repulsed in battle after battle the invading Roman Catholic armies, we hear no more of communal ownership. It was about 100 years after these Bohemian upheavals that Germany witnessed two outbreaks of communistic millenarianism which have remained celebrated right down to the present day. The first of these occurred during the Peasants' War of 1525. On that occasion, a former priest named Thomas Münzer built up a revolutionary organization which he called the League of the Elect. This body, which had several hundred members, seems to have consisted mainly of urban unemployed and of workers in the copper mines. Münzer himself was a fanatical millenarian who lived in constant tense expectation of the second coming. And he too expected the second coming to restore the lost primal state of total equality and community. Moreover, he was convinced that the second coming would take place only when all the rich and the nobles had been killed. It was for this purpose that he trained and indoctrinated his so-called League of the Elect. In reality, the intervention of this body in the Peasants' War was brief and futile. It operated only for a couple of days and only in one area, Thuringia, and all it achieved was to ensure that the crushing of the Thuringian peasantry was an even bloodier business than it would have been otherwise. Now, Münzer himself was executed, but he found successors on the extreme left of the widespread religious movement which we know as Anabaptism. In the Westphalian city of Münster, in the years 1534-35, a group of radical Anabaptists succeeded in setting up a theocratic regime which was characterized by a fairly complete community of goods. What enabled them to do this was the existence in nearby Holland and Frisia of a large proletariat which was living in a state of perpetual insecurity. These people streamed into Münster. They soon dominated the town. Besieged by a coalition of the neighboring towns and principalities, the communistic New Jerusalem of Münster held out through incredible hardships. And in fact, it never did surrender. After part of the population had starved to death, the town was stormed and all the surviving males were massacred. What gave these people the strength to endure so much was the doctrine which they had been taught by their leaders, Jan Matthys and Jan Bokkelsen. And the purport of that doctrine was, yet again, that Christ was about to reappear on earth and to put himself at the head of the faithful of Münster. Then he and his army would kill all the great ones and establish community of goods throughout the world. What is one to make of these late millenarian movements of the 15th and 16th centuries? Certainly, there is in them a social radicalism which had not existed in the millenarian movements of earlier times. For this reason, they've sometimes been interpreted as expressions of a widespread popular craving for a totally egalitarian, quasi-communistic order. By way of conclusion, I propose now to consider just how far this claim is justified. One thing at least is clear. When a millenarian group of this kind emerged into daylight, it was always because some great revolt or revolution was in progress. This was the case every time. The Bohemian extremists that I talked about operated during the early stages of the Hussite Revolution. Thomas Münzer and his League of the Elect made their brief appearance during the German Peasants' Revolt in 1525. The same can even be said of the radical Anabaptists of Münster, because before they established their New Jerusalem, there had already been a series of revolts, not only in that town, but all through various states round about. That much is generally recognized. What is not generally recognized is how little these extremist groups had in common with the mass risings to which they attached themselves. Yet the contrast leaps to the eye as soon as one considers what kind of objectives these mass movements set themselves. I'm talking now of the mass movements. What were the objectives of the Hussites? Well, they were concerned to expropriate the church in Bohemia, and incidentally the German aliens who dominated that church, and also to increase the status and independence of the laity as against the clergy. As for the German peasants in 1525, they were a rising, relatively prosperous class, but they were threatened by the rise of new territorial states. And their aim was to defend their traditional rights against encroachments and also, where possible, to strengthen the autonomy of their traditional communities. And if we turn to the ecclesiastical states of Northwest Germany, we find that the powerful and wealthy guilds in the capital cities were striving forcefully to restrict the economic privileges and immunities of the local clergy. Well, enough of that rather tedious interlude. The point is that although these aims were not in any case realized, they were at least precise, concrete, practical. The picture presented by the millenarian groups, on the other hand, is quite different. In each case, their aims were determined not by the objective social situation, but by the salvationist fantasies of a handful of freelance preachers. And those aims were correspondingly boundless. For what these preachers offered to their followers wasn't simply a chance to improve their material lot. It was also, and above all, the prospect of carrying out a divinely ordained mission of stupendous, unique importance. On the strength of supernatural revelations, the social conflict of the moment was presented as different in kind from all other struggles known to history, a cataclysm from which the world was to emerge totally transformed and redeemed. A group fighting such a battle under a divinely inspired leader inevitably regarded itself as an elite set infinitely above the rest of mankind, infallible and above all laws. And this was indeed the case. Though their ideology was thoroughly egalitarian, in their emotional attitudes these revolutionary groups were extremely elitist. They were just as elitist as those Franciscan spirituals who had seen themselves as the only true harbingers of the age of the spirit. And moreover, whereas the Franciscan spirituals at least left it to God to purify the world in preparation for the millennium, these later groups felt called upon to do the job themselves by exterminating all sinners. This made them far more bloodthirsty than the larger insurrectionary movements to which they attached themselves. Again and again, the same spectacle presents itself. A band of a few hundred dedicated enthusiasts struggling to master, in the interests of its own apocalyptic fantasy, a vast popular movement numbering tens or hundreds of thousands. And it wasn't simply in its aims and aspirations that the millenarian group differed from the mass movement around it. All the available evidence goes to show that it differed also in social composition. In the first place, the prophet himself. Normally he wasn't a manual worker, or even a former manual worker, but an intellectual or half-intellectual. Hauska and Münzer were former priests turned freelance preachers. While of Münzer, it's known that he was born to modest comfort, he was a graduate with a voracious appetite for books. Of the prophets at Münster, one was indeed a master baker, but the more important one, Bockelsen, was the illegitimate son of a village mayor. He was highly literate, he was in fact a failed cloth merchant. While their manifestos were composed for them by Rothmann, another former priest. There's nothing here to remind one of the peasants and artisans who led the great popular risings. And indeed, wherever the career of one of these men can be traced, it turns out that he'd been obsessed by apocalyptic fantasies for many years before it occurred to him, in the midst of some great social upheaval, to address himself to the poor as possible followers. But what of those followers? They did indeed come from the poor, but it would seem from a very special kind of poor. It is most significant that all these movements flourished in areas where there existed a population which had no institutionalized means of defending or furthering its interests. I'd like to stress that wasn't the normal situation of the medieval poor. A settled peasant or a skilled artisan might well be poor, but he was seldom defenseless. The manorial regime under which the peasants lived, that determined the lives of settled peasants, was by no means a system of uncontrolled exploitation. the custom of the manor, which bound the peasants, it also bound their lord. And moreover, village groups were tough, efficient organizations, very skilled in defending traditional rights, and even, if the opportunity offered, in extending them. And in the towns there were artisan guilds. These were formidable bodies, well able to cope with an obstinate overlord or a greedy patrician. So settled peasants and skilled artisans did not normally find themselves in helplessly exposed situations. However, such people did not form the lower strata of medieval society. Precisely in the most populous and economically advanced areas of Europe, there existed numbers of poor folk who had no organization behind them. In the countryside, there were landless peasants and farmhands. In the towns, there were journeymen and unskilled workers. Everywhere, there was a whole floating population of beggars and unemployed. It was people such as these which provided the revolutionary prophets with their following. I see no reason to believe that there existed then, any more than at any time before or since, any widespread desire to abolish private property or to establish a totally egalitarian order. But in a society where all norms were being swept away, where social tensions were mounting, where nationwide revolts were breaking out now here, now there, in such a society, the age-old millenarian fantasies could easily be transformed into quasi-communistic ideologies. And in such a society, millenarian sects could easily take the form of conspiratorial leagues struggling to turn each new revolt into the final, worldwide, world-shattering, world-transforming cataclysm. In this sense, I believe, one may truly say that these last millenarian groups of the Middle Ages stand at the threshold of the modern world, and that their story illumines some of the upheavals of our own turbulent century. Thank you for listening so patiently.
Well, thanks very much. We do have a few minutes for questions if people would like to ask them, but not for too long because Professor Cohen has to get back to the depths of the country. There is a reception afterwards to which everyone here is invited, so please. I do apologise about the competing noise of the drills behind us as well.
Some of the quotes you made of the spirituals sounded very much like the Cathars. I wondered if there was sympathy between the two groups or mutual antagonism. And a second question, whether there was any millennial overtones to the thought of the levellers in 17th century England.
Yes, well, the first point, Cathars were not millenarian. They looked forward to the total abolition of the world. They were really radical dualists who believed that the present world was created by a bad god and the best thing, it should disappear altogether. So they didn't look forward to a glorious future. And they did, as for whether the antagonism, the periods are somewhat different. The Cathars really had shot their bolt by 1220 or so, and the last lot of recognizable Cathars were exterminated in the south of France quite early, about 1220. That's just when the spirituals were beginning to get underway, and they were looking forward to 1260, a generation after. And they went on into the later centuries. So I don't think there could have been much antagonism. I think the sociology of it was also probably somewhat different, but at any rate, the Catharism is a very complicated question, but it's certainly, there's not much point of contact between the two. As for the levellers, well, that of course has been enormously, English historians now for the last couple of generations really, almost have been working on this question, though the levellers as such don't seem to have been I may say this is way, I have not worked on this myself, but as I understand it, the Levellers themselves were not really millenarian, but there were sects, again on the edge of the Leveller movement, which were decidedly of the kind that I have described here. The man really who knew most about this, or one of the men who would know a lot about this, is Christopher Hill, of course, the Oxford historian, my own generation. But that's as far as I can go, I think, in answering your questions.
Maybe I'll ask a question if nobody else wants
Nobody else has any question whatsoever.
Oh, there's one.
I think one of the most interesting things in your work are the comparisons that you draw between the historical movements that you look at, the 20th century totalitarian movements. And I wonder if you could just reflect on that a bit, because it seems to me that's a very interesting idea. Is one thing saying there are these psychological structures and patterns which exist across?
Yes. Well, of course, I have said something about that in the conclusion to the, particularly to the present edition of The Pursuit of the Millennium. I think that, and I do hint at it in the last sentence of my talk. Yes, of course, the difference is one of scale, but I would say this, that if one looks at, actually, it's very dangerous for me to talk on this subject in LSE, because this is the well-known center of these studies, and I am not a 20th century historian, and I can't really, but I think the mighty men whose seminars I have attended here in former years, like Leonard Shapiro and so on, I hardly dare open my mouth on such a subject. However, I can't dodge a question if it's asked, and I would say that one striking thing that distinguishes Leninist movements, for instance, from social democratic movements, is that it's primitive. They flourish in, on the whole, primitive countries, unless they're imposed from outside by force. They flourish in backward, when I say primitive, I know it's bad, but that word also is taboo, backward countries, economically backward countries, disorganized by the movement into the modern world. They do not notably flourish in the countries where Marx expected them to flourish, where he expected communism to flourish. I mean, communism on the whole has never come to power, unless imposed from outside, it's never come to power in an economically and technologically advanced country. So that, I think, is perhaps as far as I dare go. There are other questions. Of course, there are other forms of totalitarianism at our time, but as I haven't touched on the medieval antecedents of Hitler, I won't do so now. He had medieval antecedents very clearly, more clearly than Lenin, much more clearly. But that is another subject. I can't go into that now. Are there any other questions? Now, I don't know whether to interpret this as the fact that this lecture has been so totally uninteresting that no thought has occurred to anybody, or whether, on the contrary, it has been so stimulating that everyone is absolutely exhausted. yes, there's someone. I think the person below has present.
Well, two questions
come to
anyway.
You next.
Yeah.
Please.
It follows on rather well from the previous.
Is it working?
Hello? It is working. the question follows on from the previous one and perhaps expands on it. Whether or not millenarianism is, in a sense, not just present across time in very different contexts, but also across cultures. Whether or not millenarianism, with the three core characteristics that you identified, exists in Islamic
states. It does. There is actually now, about present-day millenarianism, it's not always socially oriented in the way that I've discussed. I mean, I've given two types of millenarianism which flourish in the Middle Ages, and one of them, I think, has clear parallels in our own time. But there are other forms, quite other forms, and forms that flourish in the Far East. For instance, Japan and the Aum movement is certainly millenarian. The Islam has the whole long tradition of Mahdi movements of millenarium, and very good introduction to the ones which are flourishing at the moment, not in Islam, but in the world in the rest of the world, is the book by Damien Thompson, The End of Time, now available in paperback. Excellent work. He covers the whole thing from the American movements, which of course are flourishing mightily, to Aum, and Damien Thompson. Really very good, I think, The End of Time. Now, it is of course secular, but if you trace, well, this is a mighty big subject. It is of course a secular ideology, but if you take somewhat wider perspective and say, does it look forward to a perfected world in which human beings will be totally different from what they've been hitherto, and in which all problems will be solved? There, I think you can call it a millenarian movement. I am not, of course, the first to do so. It has been called so since before the Second World War. I can think of several books, I don't think at any point I might tell you their names or the authors and so on, who advanced this theory already in the 1930s. They called the secular millenarianism is what they called both Nazism and communism. And these books were written, I can think of one which appeared in 1938, and I can think of I can think of others in various languages, but I won't go into all that now. So I agree with the secular, yes, call it secular millenarianism. But millenarian it is, in its, both in its ambitions and, I would say, in its sociology, in this sense, that you have a self-appointed group of intellectuals or semi-intellectuals cashing in on mass disorientation, rather than a group of trade union leaders getting down to the job of improving the state of the workers. That's perhaps as far as I can go.
Well, I think there we probably ought to finish. Can I re-invite anyone who wants to come to the reception, which is actually in the, I believe, in the senior common room on the fifth floor, and again express our thanks. Terrific subject, really interesting discussion of it. We're really grateful, and I'm very pleased to have welcomed Professor Cohen to the LSE, and I hope it won't be too long before he comes back again, rather than simply staying away for many, many years, I gather he's done. So thanks very, very much.